Welcome to the Allowed Podcast. I'm Louise Steinman, curator of the Allowed series, presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Allowed is a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. To learn more about Allowed and learn how you can help the Library Foundation of Los Angeles support the Los Angeles Public Library, please go to our website, www.alloudla.org. The Allowed program you're about to hear was produced in 2009. We have a very distinguished panel tonight to discuss Wallace Stegner and the shaping of environmental consciousness in the West. Tonight's program is partially supported by Poets and Writers, Inc. through a grant it has received from the James Irvine Foundation, and we're very grateful for their support. After the discussion by our panel, we will open to questions from you all. And Justin will circulate the mic, so please wait until it comes to you so we can all hear you, and also because we record for podcast. And I also ask that you turn off your cell phones and pagers. I'm going to introduce our moderator, David L. Ulan, and then he'll introduce the rest of our panel. David is the book editor of the Los Angeles Times and the author of The Myth of Solid Ground, Earthquakes, Prediction, and the Fault Line Between Reason and Faith. If you were here last week for our earthquake panel, we had the privilege of hearing David on that. It was a great panel. And he's the editor of Another City, Writing from Los Angeles and Writing Los Angeles, a literary anthology, which won a California Book Award. He's written for many publications, including the New York Times Book Review, Los Angeles, and NPR's All Things Considered. David cares about and has thought deeply about this topic, so I know we're in good hands tonight. And I turn it over to you, David. Take it away.
Thanks, Louise. excuse me. I'm going to introduce the panelists, and then we'll get started. We're going to talk for 55 minutes or an hour or so, and then we'll turn it over to some questions from the floor. I'm just going to kind of go down the line, and I'm going to just read the bios that were sent to me, so some are longer and some are shorter. To my far left, Jenny Price is a writer and Los Angeles urban ranger who writes primarily about urban nature, ideas of nature, and Los Angeles environment. She loves the sewer-like LA River and the Malibu beaches, where she writes about public access equally passionately. She has a PhD in history from Yale, the author of Flight Maps, Adventures with Nature in Modern America. She has written for Good, The Believer, Audubon, Sunset, The New York Times, Los Angeles Times, The Washington Post, and she contributes to the online Native Intelligence column at LA Observe. To my immediate left is Paige Stegner, who is the editor of Wallace Stegner's West, the book that is the launching pad for tonight's discussion. Paige is a graduate of Stanford University. He was a professor of American literature and director of the creative writing program at the University of California, Santa Cruz from 1967 to 1995, retiring in 1995 to devote full time to his writing. He's the author of many books, including The Edge, Hawks and Harriers, Sports Car Menopause, Escape into Aesthetics, American Places with Wallace Stegner and Elliot Porter, Outposts of Eden, and we can go on. Once we do the introductions, Paige is going to read a quick sample from the book just to sort of set the context, and then we'll move on from there. To my immediate right, Bill Deverill is the director of the Huntington USC Institute on California and the West and a professor of history at USC. He earned his undergraduate degree in American Studies from Stanford, where we were just hearing backstage as a nervous undergraduate he once had lunch with Wallace Stegner. Maybe we'll talk about that. He received his MA and PhD in American History from Princeton, where he studied under the supervision of James McPherson. He is the author of works exploring the 19th and 20th century American West. Recent publications include Whitewashed Adobe, The Rise of Los Angeles, and The Remaking of Its American Past, which is a truly remarkable book, and Land of Sunshine, The Environmental History of Metropolitan Los Angeles, which he co-edited with Greg Heiss. And to my far right is my colleague at the Los Angeles Times, Tom Kerwin, whose bio I now can't find. Oh, here we go. Short and sweet. Currently, writer-editor on the News Side, Pulitzer finalist 2008, editor-at-large in features. He is the former editor of the late lamented Outdoors section of the Los Angeles Times and the former deputy editor of the Los Angeles Times Book Review. So welcome, all of you. Thanks for being here. And Paige, if you want to start with a benediction.
A benediction, okay. I thought about what kind of benediction I would begin with, and my father's not known for being a great comic. I had a few lunches with him myself, and I was just as scared as you were. And this book is not filled with humorous pieces, but there's so I tried to find something that was a little light and a little general that would start, and it's a couple of passages from an essay called Why I Like the West. And I don't remember where I found this. I reprinted it in a collection of his work called Marking the Sparrow's Fall. And it was just some magazine piece I dug up somewhere. But anyway, here's just a little bit of it to set the flavor. A wild man from the West, I have always done my honest best to live up to what tradition says I should be. I've always tried to look like Gary Cooper and talk like the Virginian. I've endeavored to be morally upright, courteous to women, with an innate sense of right and wrong, but without the polish that Yale College or European travel might have put upon me. I have consented to be forgiven my frontier gaucheries, and I did not hold it against the waiter in the Parker House bar when he removed my feet from the upholstery. I have been breezy, frank, healthy, relaxed, with a drawling soul and an open heart and a friendly smile. I have obediently liked my beef well done and my R's hard, and have let it be known that I eat fried potatoes with my scrambled eggs for breakfast. Without actually wilting when the population was more than 10 to the square mile, I have expressed a sense of crowding, and I have publicly honored a friend of mine who moved on from his ranch when it got so crowded he had to put a door on his privy. I've done all this in obedience to the myth of the West, and while doing it, I have served as a self-appointed evangelist to rescue unfortunate Eastern heathens from the climate, topography, theology, prejudices, literature, railroads, traditions, narrowness, and geographical ignorance that is their heritage. I have not always been thanked, but I have been earnest. Any conversation which has permitted me to discuss redwood trees, Sierra forests, western rivers, canyons or plateaus, Pacific surf, Utah trout fishing, or long-distance views has been a honeyhead in which I could happily drown. I've been full of comparative statistics on areas, altitudes, distances, the fact that my favorite county in Utah is somewhat larger than the state of Massachusetts is something I cannot keep to myself. Under the hesitant, skeptical, and envious questioning of Easterners, I confess to the same sense of well-being that I once felt in Devon while trying to convince a mule-headed young Britisher that in the United States, bread comes ready sliced. The paltry Eastern landscape I have given my patronizing scorn. Have never been able to refrain from telling Easterners that Mount Washington, their pride, could be set down in the Grand Canyon in a ditch and never show above the rim. They try to greet these revelations with well-bred astonishment or to laugh them off, but I have seen their souls warp under the strain. Anything the thing they can cite, I can cite bigger. One last paragraph. When I went back east to school in Iowa, I took with me the belligerent thesis that all virtue, all good country, all pleasant people, and all pretty girls lay back of me, west of the Missouri, if not west of the Rockies. But later, when I found myself an odd sparrow among the polite rustlings of the Ivy League, I cheerfully acceded to local custom and included in the West the Iowa and Wisconsin and Illinois I had once fiercely attacked as a feat colorless and insipid. One glance at the New Yorkers or the Bostonians' map of the United States will make it clear how I could get away with this, and also how great an advantage any Westerner has in a regional argument. Whatever he may not know, a Westerner is bound to know geography, and among the heathen, he can claim anything for his province and get away with it. If he wants to, he can start the west at the Alleghenies or the eastern edge of Indiana. And if he's challenged, he can conduct a defense in depth. Ohio, Illinois, Iowa, Nebraska, eastern Colorado. He can retreat all the way to the Rockies. And by that time, he will have his opponent extended and can whip around and cut his supply lines. And if he is still pressed, there are Montana and Wyoming and Idaho and Utah and Nevada and California, New Mexico and Arizona and Texas to wage a war of movement in. The Easterner who once lets it get established that there is such a thing as the West hasn't got a chance in a quarrel of regional patriotism. He is Napoleon in Russia.
All right. I think we're going to do this as more of a conversation rather than directed questions at particular panelists. So let me just start by throwing out as a general idea for anyone and everyone. What that passage evokes is a kind of myth of the West. Obviously, it's playing with the myth of the West. Almost the sort of Neil Cassidy type Westerner that Easterners fantasize about. But it seems to me that is also one of the inherent tensions in Stegner's work, certainly, and in terms of thinking about the West seriously, both in terms of literature, in terms of environmentalism, in terms of culture. What's the balance between myth and reality, and how does it work, and how does that passage sort of set us up for that? Does anyone want to just take the plunge? I could call on people. I do teach.
I think that's really an interesting point. I mean, I wrote down myth as Paige was reading that, and I guess that's one of the things that I admire so much about Wall Stegner's writing is that, I mean, that passage, a great passage. On one hand, he offers you this great sort of travelogue, which I first discovered Wall Stegner as a kid reading the Sound of Mountain Water and just falling in love with that really brief little bit of writing on Rediscovery of America, 1946, when he went on a driving tour of the West, and just found myself sort of just lost in just his easy sort of narrative prose and lost in just the descriptions of the campfires and just the people and the things that he saw as he was exploring, the Colorado River, Meade and Lake Powell, and then driving up towards Utah and over the summit at Lake Tahoe. So on one hand, I love the narrative quality to it, which is very much rooted in the reality of the West, but he also sort of does wonderful sort of lip service in some manner to the myth of the West. It's in one of these stories this passage just sort of jumped out at me in a nice way, if I can find it very quickly. The character writes about finding a place to live, and he says, "Coming here, we kept at least the illusion of making our own choices." You know, they didn't come here to make their own choices. They came here to keep the illusion that they could make their own choices. It's not as if you have a chance to. You can't live the myth, but you can choose to respect the myth. And Stegner seems to be able to acknowledge that in his writing. So it's just not sort of dumb fealty to the notion of the myth, but the idea that the myth is what keeps people alive. And in the case of the West, it gives us a chance to believe that we don't have to be constrained by the past, the great American notion of the past that Westerners always sort of fled from.
I second that very much in that one of the things that struck me most when I was reading through the collection was this conflicted sense of, you know, myth versus reality. It's complicated. You know, at first there are places where you think, well, he's really just kind of hawking the Western myth here, and then he undercuts it in a lot of ways. But I think even more than that, it's a whole set of contradictions that have characterized Western history that really come through here. You know, this tension between mobility but also wanting to be rooted in a place that very much comes through here. And there's a sense of, you know, individual freedom but also wanting some kind of community, between local determination but accepting that you need the feds in the West, you know, to manage water. And it's this whole set of kind of tensions and contradictions that I think really get at the heart of Western history and I really felt like on one hand he was pointing them out. On the other hand, it was also very much reflecting those myths. Wasn't clear to me they completely grappled with them himself. And that may be also more of a function of, that he was writing more in the 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, I think, before we got, say, Ecology of Fear instead of, his phrase, which was the Geography of Hope.
Like the difference between Obama and Bush.
The other thing that Jenny's reflecting on, as well as Tom, I think, this almost binary distinction between myth and reality or mobility and rootedness, but never quite so binary, because Stegner's in the middle of it, really, with his own life and his own fiction and history. He's good at both, which is a pretty rare talent. I think it was Forrest Robinson, a literary critic, who talked in some critical works about Stegner, saying that Stegner existed in this middle ground and that he himself utilized the term a fair amount in his writing. And I think that's exactly right. It's now a term that historians really use a lot conceptually. But if you look at the life and work of somebody like Wallace Stegner, he not only exemplified it, but he does inhabit it in what he does. And all those questions about the West that Jenny listed, I think biographically as well as in his own work, he epitomized them. It's very interesting.
But a lot of the writing doesn't feel so much like there's been a resolution or a coming to terms or a mixing of these things. To me it seems there's a lot of tension between these. One of the things that's very characteristic about these contradictions, which I think are really American contradictions, and he says, about the West Coast, it's America, but more so, is that, which I think is right on, that you want both. So it's less of, I think a lot of Western history has been less of, trying to really resolving those than in wanting both in a lot of ways. And the ultimate contradiction being the one between probably city and wild.
I think so. And I think, Paige would know this far better than I think than any of us on the panel, but I think in addition to that, that lack of resolution, there's also, in my view, about the West, there's an arc of disappointment in Stegner's writing. About what the West, not necessarily is, but what it will become. And that may be a topic that David wants to take up toward the end of the evening.
It's an interesting question. I want to come back to that, but I also want to say there's that fascinating point where he comes over the crest of Tahoe and he says, we talk about what we've done to the mountains, but what we ought to talk about is what the mountains do to us or do for us. Mm-hmm. And he explains what's interesting to me about it is he's looking at development. But he's looking at development through a very human filter. I mean, he's worried about development, but he's understanding sort of emotionally where that urge, why people are coming here. Why are people building on the lip of Tahoe, on the shores of Tahoe, because of what that landscape does for those people, what it means to be in that place. And that too, I think, is part of that tension, that sense of contradiction. You can't have one without the other. Paige, do you want to jump in on some of what Jenny was asking about in terms of?
Well, I agree that tension is there, but I think it comes down much harder on the myth than he does on the reality. Finally, and it's finally the myth that drives him nuts, and is the root cause of a lot of what's in his mind wrong with or the West. And I was thinking when you tied on a Y, I was thinking of Larry McMurtry, who was a student of my old man's and was at Stanford when we all were. And somebody that my father admired a lot, his work, particularly the early stuff, Leaving Cheyenne, A Horseman Passed By. And he absolutely hated Lonesome Dove.
Your father?
My father. And I said, I had a big argument with him. Because it took every Western cliche that there is and put them all together in one book. He didn't forget anything. Right. And I'm sure he did it absolutely on purpose. I mean, we had this big argument about whether Larry had deliberately taken all of the cliches about the West, the noble whores and the villainous savages and all that, and mixed them all together. But ultimately, it didn't matter to him whether he did it on purpose or by accident, because he'd done it. And he thought it just perpetrated the kind of Louis L'Amour sense of.
Right, the J. Frank Dobie thing. I think it's interesting because I have exactly the same reaction of Lonesome Dove, because McMurtry had written that great essay in A Narrow Grave where he basically says, I'm never going to do that. You know, where he dismisses J. Frank Dobie and all of those Texas writers who perpetuate that myth and stands against it, and he's writing about the modern Texas, and then, you know, 15 years later, he creates the epic miniseries, you know, the source of the epic miniseries. Yeah. But it's fascinating that. I'm curious, in terms of thinking about those things, how you put this book together. You know, it's a huge body of work. And, I mean, is your sense of this book as a kind of introduction to readers who might not know the work? What were you looking for? There's a real balance between the fiction and the nonfiction. It's built around this notion of the West, but it's as big an amorphous. I mean, the West is a big amorphous concept, and I think one of the strengths of the book is that it doesn't try to pin down the West in any way, much as your father didn't try to. You know, he observed it without trying to put it in a box. I'm curious about the strategy of putting this thing together.
Well, I'd like to claim that there was more of one than there probably really was. The original idea was Malcolm Margolin's, and who approached me and asked it, and because he has a series called the California Legacy series, in which he a lot of California writers, Saroyan and John Muir and what have you, and he thought it would be great to have a Wallace Stegner's California. And so I said, oh, yeah, okay, and I'll find some stuff and write an introduction for you. And then when I got around to doing it, I realized that very little of what my father wrote is about California. There are 35 published books, novels, of which two are set in California, and part of one another, part of another. Angle of Repose has some California sections, but basically it's not a California novel in any sense of the word. There are 57 short stories. Four are set in California. 257 articles and essays, and I, you know, was hard pressed to find very many, you know, that were, and certainly very many that had the kind of intellectual depth that the one that's in here has, which was the only one I could find. So I wrote Malcolm or said, we've got a problem here. The California writer isn't a California writer. He lives here, but that isn't really what you mean by it. And so he said, we'll just expand the horizons and call it Wallace Stegner's West. So then I began to, he wanted some fiction and he wanted some nonfiction. And unfortunately, I confess this, I think the four stories that are in here are all California stories. And I don't think they're his best stories by any means. And I'm kind of, I mean, what can I do? I didn't write them. A lot of his best stories are in Saskatchewan, parts of the Big Rock Candy Mountain, or Vermont. And Vermont certainly didn't fit the category of anything here. So I went with the California stories. And then I also wanted to get a little spread in time, which that essay that I read from is, I think, 1950s or something. The rediscovery of America is way early. Road trips, and you know, I think I was 9 years old when that took place. But I also wanted to include the evolution of the thought. So that's why there's a piece in here called Striking the Rock, which was one of three essays that my father wrote for the University of Michigan, the Cook Lecture Series, and it was published as a book called The American West as a Living Space. And it's probably, you know, his best and most definitive thinking about and consolidation of everything he ever had to say about the West in that one book. And the movement from some of this early ebullience, where he goes to visit Hoover Dam and Lake Mead and says, "Wow, isn't that great? I mean, look at that." To the last lines of Striking the Rock, which he's talking about what one should make of these depressing facts that he has enumerated before the end. And he says, "Sad to say, they make me admit when I face them that the West is no more the Eden that I once thought it than the garden of the world that the boosters and engineers tried to make it. And that neither nostalgia nor boosterism can any longer make a case for it as the geography of hope."
I have to touch in on that.
There goes that myth.
See, that's and I think that's really one of the reasons why I fell in love with Stegner as a kid, was the fact that he was able to talk about Lake Powell and Lake Mead in those early essays in such sort of awestruck, boosterist ways. I mean, he talks about how absolutely gorgeous the water is cast up against those red cliffs. And I was really struck by that, because then you read his later essays when he almost goes full circle on it and recognizes what a ditch has been created there and that's doomed to fail. And I guess what I found so appealing about that was his willingness and his ability to sort of show the human side of himself as an essay writer and as a thinker of the West, and to be able to be bold enough and sort of out front enough to sort of show us a little bit of the evolution of his thought, not so dogmatic that he digs in his heels in so long that he's not able to bend a little bit with sort of the changing perception and reality of what the West has become.
And you have to remember, too, that through that long arc from the, let's say, the immediate post-war through the mm-hmm. 70s and 80s, not only do I think Tom's exactly right that he's rethinking about a lot of things about Western landscape and federal intervention, et cetera, environmental damage and degradation, he's also getting leaned on by Bernard DeVoto, by David Brower, by Ansel Adams, friends and colleagues who are leaning on him to play, because of his masterful ability to put words together, leaning on him to play this, to have this obligation to speak out through his print about some of these things. So I think it's a community of people that he's very close to who are helping him get to the other side of the coin.
And that line "community" that you just used, Bill, is so good, because there's that one, that really interesting and kind of essay that surprised me in this book, The Committee of the Green Foothills, the letter, I guess, he was getting an award from a group of citizens up in the Bay Area around Palo Alto, I guess, for the conservation work that he'd done there. And he closes the essay just thanking them, but saying, you know, he has a great line in there that talks about how you get the best feeling for a place if you have to fight for it. And I thought about you, Jenny, and your work for the LA River, the sense of getting a feeling for a place if you have to fight for it. But then he closes the essay with a very sort of bittersweet sentence or two that talks about how, you know, I was in an orphanage as a kid, and I hope that this is, as he talks to the people in this committee, this is a community that I hope to be a part of for a long time. So it's as if he'd finally found a home in this community and a place in the West as being a champion for these conservation issues.
I really wonder what Wallace Stegner would have thought of the LA River. I wish I could have. I don't know if he ever wrote about it or mentioned it. I think he probably would have avoided doing that. But it actually makes me think of, again, when I read this book, it really brought back when I was growing up in the 60s and 70s and reading a lot of nature writing, of which I thought this is just brilliant example. I mean, if you've ever spent a lot of time in the West or you've had a wilderness experience, you just relive it when you read these essays and stories. The writing is just so vivid and just precise, up to like the way the roadkill shimmers in the, you know, in the heat. But it reminds me of sort of the trajectory from that kind of nature writing to, you know, Los Angeles now, and the kinds of environmentalism that are centered more around things like the LA River now, because that kind of writing, I think, was really important to a kind of 60s and 70s environmentalism whose kind of heart and soul was about wilderness preservation, and really fired up people like me and a whole generation of people to really, and that was really kind of the heart and soul of environmentalism and got us to where we are today. But at the same time, I think environmentalism really started to change in the 80s, you know, in the 90s when actually he started to get disaffected, and because of those folks, we've actually not really moved away from wilderness, but really started to look at cities as much as wilderness. So it was very much a kind of marker of that history of environmentalism, and a marker also of how that created eventually a kind of very different kind of environmental attitudes and approach that we have today.
I had sort of a pang as I read this collection, sort of a nostalgic pang for that type of writing and that sort of eloquence. I don't find that as abundant as I'd like it to be nowadays.
But
I
we're think more ironic now.
This kind of eloquence.
Yeah, I was thinking, you know, the great conservationist Aldo Leopold. I mean, his writings are so beautiful and so eloquent and so moving for their purpose. And Stegner reminded me of those writings an awful lot. And I had to think to myself, who nowadays is reading Aldo Leopold and Wallace Stegner and actually sort of thinking about finding a cause to champion?
Well, this raises a couple of interesting points. I'm trying to figure out which one to jump in on first. One of the things that is interesting is this notion of cities, because it seems to me that certainly in the pieces in this book, part of what Stegner's writing about is a kind of a more rural West, or at least the tension between a rural West and an undeveloped West. He talks in Striking the Rock, he opens Striking the Rock with a description which I'll, you know, the summer of 1948, my family and I spent on Strother Burt's ranch in Jackson Hole. During that busy and instructive interval, my wife and I were also acting as Western editors and scouts for a publishing house, and now and then someone came by with a manuscript for a book. The most memorable of these was a famous architect contemplating his autobiography. One night he showed us slides of some of his houses, including a million-dollar palace, 1948 million-dollar palace, in the California desert, of which he was very proud. He said it demonstrated that with imagination, technical know-how, modern materials, and enough money, an architect could build anywhere without constraints, imposing his vision on any site. I'm paraphrasing slightly just for speed. In that waterless, pale desert, spotted with shade shale and creosote bush and backed by barren lion-colored mountains, another sort of architect, say Frank Lloyd Wright, might have designed something contextual, something low, broad-eaved, thick-walled, something that would mitigate the hot light, something half-underground so that people could retire like the lizards and rattlesnakes from the intolerable daytime temperatures, something made of native stone or adobe or tamped earth in the colors and shapes of the country, something no more visually obtrusive than an outcrop. Not this architect. He had built of cinder block in the form of Bauhaus cubes, the only right angles in that desert. He had painted them a dazzling white. Instead of softening the lines between building and site, he had accentuated them, surrounding his sugary cubes with acres of lawn and a tropical oasis of oleanders, hibiscus, and palms, not the native Washingtonia palms either, which are a little scraggly, but sugar and royal palms with a classier, more Santa Barbara look. Water for this estancia, enough water to have sustained a whole tribe of desert Indians, had been brought by private pipeline from the mountain. Mountains literally miles away. The patio around the pool, who would live in the desert without a pool, would have fried the feet of swimmers 300 days out of the year, so he had designed canopies that could be extended and retracted by push button, and under the patio's concrete, my favorite detail, he had laid pipes through which cool water circulated by day. By night, after the desert chill came on, the circulating water was heated. He had created an artificial climate inside and out. Okay, so this becomes a metaphor for the absurdity of this kind of inability to adapt to the environment and the idea that we're going to control it. And then Stegner writes, that desert house seemed to me and still seems to me a paradigm, hardly a paradigm, more of a caricature of what we have been doing to the West in my lifetime. Instead of adapting as we began to do, we have tried to make the country and climate over to fit our existing habits and desires. Instead of listening to the silence, we have shouted into the void. We have tried to make the arid West into what it was never meant to be and cannot remain, the garden of the world and the home of multiple millions. But the fact to me is that now, all these years later, it's inevitably
irrevocably the home, you know, the garden of the world and the home of the millions. It's mm-hmm. I mean, the West is, for all of its open spaces, is very much an urban region or collection of regions, as much so as any other region or collection of regions in the country.
Yeah, I'm good.
Well, yeah, but one which, if you live in the Southwest, as I do, which has been suffering, well, I guess California too, it's not exempt, a terrific drought for a number of years. The Colorado River, as everybody knows, is running way less than it was ever, even in normal years, projected or ran. Lake Mead is half empty. Lake Powell is half empty. The Western, Pat Mulroy, who's the Southern Nevada water manager and one of the best, basically manages water for Las Vegas, has said in 3 more years of drought in Las Vegas will lose 40% of its water. 5 more years of drought and it will lose 90% of its water because the lake will have dropped below the intake pipes that feed the city. And there are not a lot of people that are confident that that drought is suddenly going to end, never mind global warming, just the normal cycles. So the, you know, it starts with John Wesley Powell, who says, you know, this country will not sustain this kind of. And then there's Stegner, who's echoing Powell, and then a lot of pieces thundering about aridity and overdevelopment, and one of these days it's all going to come crashing down. And it looks as if one of these days may not be very far off.
We're fixing it here.
You are.
We're going to provide all of our own water.
Barack,
right?
Obama's going to fix it.
Absolutely. He's going to help us. We're going to revitalize
water.
The LA River. We're going to do watershed management. We're going to provide all of our own water. Right?
You know, I was.
And don't laugh. Don't laugh. It's actually in the midst of happening, potentially, or at least most of our own water. Potentially. It's possible. It's possible. But I think that in order to get to the kind of things that are going on in LA right now, with really grappling with how do we manage our water wisely, which we, to put it mildly, have not done for many decades, that we had to take that critique of the architect out of the desert and bring it into the cities. How do you live with nature in the cities? And that's something that I think the Wilderness Ideal did not prepare us to do. The Wilderness Ideal was based on the idea that there was uninhabited land. Of course, in order to create that American past, we had to de-inhabit the land. So, you know, we had to get rid of the people who actually did live on it. So, in order for it to become uninhabited wilderness. So, I mean, I'm just repeating an argument that's been made many times, but so I think that ideal has always involved a lot of erasure of really thinking about how we manage nature and how we live with nature. And of course, most of us live in the city, so how do we do that in the city? So when I was talking about sort of different kinds of environmentalism, I think the main difference I see between 20th century environmentalism, which was really powered by this really powerful kind of nature writing, and 21st century environmentalism, it's really moved into the cities to think about how to deal with nature in the places where we live, which you can't preserve wilderness without doing that either. And so to also really think about those connections, which I think it's taken that move a long time to happen, but I think it's finally arrived. And I think Stegner, you know, really helped us get there. At the same time, I think that wilderness ideal kind of kept us from seeing a lot of our connections to nature here.
And I would just echo something Paige said, that passage that David read, that's written by a biographer of John Wesley Powell. There's no doubt that Stegner's historical work to write Beyond the 100th Meridian is what set him up, in essence, intellectually, to have that bully pulpit to write that. And what's not been done with Stegner's work is to tie the genres of his writing together environmentally between fiction, nonfiction, like biography, and then the essays. We've tended to talk about Stegner, the fiction stylist, and then Stegner, the environmentalist, or the environmental activist, and not put those all together, because they really are of a piece. I mean, when Tom talks about reading Stegner's fiction and the depictions of the natural environment, that's Stegner, the environmentally conscious person on the landscape writing. And there's a real through line there about aridity, perhaps most prominently, but also about great spaces of the interior American West And I think you could hold the whole body of work together that way.
And also, I think if you look at Beyond the 100th Meridian, just as a narrative work, that also has much in common with the narrative force of the fiction as well.
It's really fascinating what we're talking about. I'm struck by what Jenny was saying about 21st century nature writing, activism, being in the city, and comparing it with, say, Stegner. And I guess the thing that, to touch on what Bill said, was just what I find so interesting about Stegner's writing is that it is so rooted in the history. I mean the Bernard DeVoto sort of ethic that's sort of laced throughout his pieces, the deep knowledge of the history that precedes everything that he's writing is so, I find as a reader, just so captivating, and it feels like it really has a strong foundation that in turn makes me feel that the writing that's coming out of the city, as perhaps you characterize it, Jenny, nowadays, does not have quite that sort of a foundation and feels a little bit less substantial, perhaps a little bit more sort of just of the here and now rather than rooted in something with a greater depth.
I'm going to take you on a little
Please
bit.
Please do.
We've done this before with each other. But, I mean, to me, in some ways, I think that's partly because we associate kind of nature and the Western past and the ways in which, you know, open spaces, this myth of, you know, wilderness being so essential to the formation of American character, we associate that with depth. That nature is what's real, you know, it's the authentic America, it's the real America, it's sort of the place with the moral authority for our national identity. And so I think that when you have a kind of nature writing that doesn't tap into that so much, maybe it seems like it has less weight. It's also, typically nature writing has not been funny either. So I think that, you know, maybe when you have nature writing, except for Edward Abbey, I would say was, you know, the major exception in that tradition. So, I just wonder if part of its depth has to do, in fact, with the ways it taps into those myths about the West and nature. Does that make sense? But go ahead, take me on.
No. I'm putting it together in my mind, so don't call me quite yet. Let me think about that.
Well, let me raise the specter of regionalism, which is something that that Stegner addresses in some of these essays, and addresses it in a kind of complicated and skeptical way, as something that's a stage, not an end goal. And Paige, I want to ask you about this first, and then we can all jump in. That, you know, one of the dangers, he doesn't use this word, but in LA it seems an appropriate word to use, that one of the dangers of regionalism is that it can yield to a kind of boosterism, where we're supporting something simply because it's ours, not because it's good. And that that can have to do, excuse me, that can be an aesthetic issue, that can be a political issue, that can be an environmental issue. I'm curious your thoughts on the whole regional question and your father's sense of it, and then everyone else, please feel free to pile on.
I'm not sure that I have any at the moment. The question of regionalism in terms of...
Well, I mean, you know, again, in terms of the myth versus reality question, the West is a region, but the West isn't a region. The West is a collection of regions. And regionalism is often used in a way, I think, to marginalize regions like, you know, California or New Mexico or Texas that aren't the dominant region of a national culture, right? No one ever says that the Northeast is regional. Northeastern culture is never regional, it's American culture. Every other region's culture is regional, but never American. But he raises some very interesting points about the importance of regionalism in terms of establishing a foothold, but also a kind of skepticism about regionalism as a sort of oversimplification.
He talks about it as, you know, the West being many regions, but he does also talk about the one unifying common denominator of aridity, that virtually all of these subregions or whatever you want to call them share a lack of less than 11 inches of rain a year. Agriculture that can't be sustained by anything other than irrigation. So I'm not really answering your question.
No, does anyone want to jump in on this question?
You know, Stegner, in a sense, is sort of a prisoner of his own intellect in this, because the guy knew the West, or at least his West, you know, the plains, the interior West, the Rocky Mountain West, Saskatchewan. You know, he knew Canada better than 99% of American Western historians ever pay attention to Canada. he knew it so well. He had a kind of cartographic and topographic and even geological knowledge of the West that comes out of the fiction. I mean, it's really this sort of what we term old-fashioned knowledge. And it's not particularly old-fashioned. It just was so good and so thick that he couldn't help but give regional definition to what he wrote about because the details are there in all the fiction or even the nonfiction. But in many of his interviews and things, he's clearly a student, a really capable student of American literary tradition. And he understands American literature, and he understands the timelessness of certain situations and certain character developments and certain problems in literature. And his characters go through that, you know, that usual litany of stories that sustain literary investigations about relationships, life, hopes, dreams, etc. He's got them all there, but it's so thickly described, I think in a beautiful way myself, of the West, that in terms of Eastern critics and all, that they were perfectly happy, I suspect, to pigeonhole him as a Western voice. He was the next A.B. Guthrie, when in fact he's really much, much more, in my view.
William Stegner, they called him.
William Stegner, I saw that, yeah.
And I guess what I find interesting, too, I mean, I go back to that passage that I read earlier where it's the illusion of choice. I mean, his West, his regional West was in so many ways not just geographic but psychological. I mean, so you didn't have to be defined as being sort of a particular region, the Southwest, the Montana, the Saskatchewan, wherever. The point was is that if you carried that sort of ethos inside of you, you're able to tap into that sort of westerning spirit that I think American literature has been talking about since you know, Nathaniel Hawthorne took young Goodman Brown out of the city and into the woods.
Go ahead, Jenny.
Well, it's held together by, you know, and when you study Western history in graduate school, you spend interminable weeks of your courses talking about, is there a West, you know? Is there such a thing as Western history? In the end, you know, there's a myth of the West, and I think that in itself has made the West, whatever that may be, quite real, and I think that's exactly what he's talking about in that, you know, excerpt you read, is he sort of says, well, there is no West, but at the same time, we think there's a West, and that's actually been really important to creating
We want there to
the
be
West.
A West.
We want there to be a West. I just say, I was telling a friend of mine that I was going to do this panel, and she teaches Western history, and she said, you know, the amazing thing about Stegner is that there's no better Western history than his fiction. You know, Angle of Repose. He said, like, if somebody asks you, I want to learn about the history of the West, you give them Angle of Repose. So, but at the same time, I think that, I mean, wasn't he sort of, and also all these students that he spawned, many of whose names would be very familiar to you, trying to make the case, trying to kind of demarginalize Western literature, and at the same time make the case that it's American literature, right? I mean, it's what you were saying with Hawthorne, because the West is supposed to be sort of where American character is formed and where American history really.
But to me it's the difference between a kind of false regionalism and then this sense of place that he also talks about a lot, and that because the West in the cultural mythos is seen as sort of a place where people don't have roots and they don't put down roots. That place isn't there. And he writes in a couple of the selections in this book about the way that we get identity through our connection to place, that identity and place are linked. And you bring up Angle of Repose. That's what Angle of Repose is fundamentally all about. What is history? Mm-hmm. What is place? What is heritage? You know, he has that great line, my grandparents are a deep vein that has never been dug. They were people. You know, which is just perfect and beautiful, and it's exactly as you say. You can learn the whole history just from the history of this, the whole history of the West, from the history of this family. But it has fundamentally to do with place, and I'm curious what you guys all think about that relationship of place and identity as a way of maybe specifying this notion of the West. It isn't about the big region or the big amorphous area that we can't wrap our minds around. It's about our own individual place here and where our roots are, how we put them down.
I think it's a complicated dance. I think it's one of the central contradictions that we started, you know, talking about early on, is that, yes, the idea of the West as one place is a mythical idea. And when you actually look at real Western places, you know, L.A., Tucson, Portland, they're all actually quite different, and those are the places you have to put roots in. At the same time, that myth has very much shaped these places as well. So I think it's actually there's no either-or answer to that question. I think that these things have been weaving around each other in the course of Western history in really complicated ways that we probably still don't understand.
And Angle of Repose also is all about genealogy. So he, you know, he's clearly a student of family history. And occasionally in his life, for interviews and things, he will talk quite a bit about parents and grandparents and this kind of line. But he does realize, I think, fundamentally, that in the midst of all this demographic fluidity of the 20th or late 19th century forward West, there are these stories of two and three and four generations deep in the same place and getting to know it and that being passed on and being very, very important. So he is a student of that as well.
Yeah, and I guess just the association I had, you were talking about, David, is just the, I find myself deeply moved by just the music of the prose, these really lyrical passages, the descriptions, I find myself as a Westerner, as an Angeleno, sort of proud and sort of, you know, and this is really kind of an old world notion, but he really hits a nerve in me as to what it means to be a Westerner and not be of a denizen of New York City, for instance, but someone who is sort of responds to these open spaces and you know, takes some form of solace from them.
And also, if you take the masterwork, if you take Angle of Repose, and you ask 12 different folks who love that book, what's it really about? You know, you get the Jenny's answer, which I think is absolutely right. You could give that book to a student who wants to know about Western history. You give it to an undergraduate and say, this will teach you a lot about the West. You give it to undergraduates and say, this will teach you about the 1960s. This is America in the 1960s. You can give it to other students and say, this is the history of American higher education since the Second World War. You can give other students and say, this is the history of irrigation in the interior Rocky Mountain West, or it's the history of Idaho, or it's the history of women on the American frontier after the Civil War.
Or family.
That's a really wonderful tribute to a really magnificent book that it covers all the and I'm sure that was all deliberate on the part of the author.
So is there, and Paige, I'll start with you and then everyone can jump in on this, is this a model for a writer that can still sustain? I was noticing yesterday reading reading a number of pieces about John Updike that there was a lot of conversation about Updike representing a kind of writer that no longer can exist in the United States because writing doesn't matter that much anymore. A novel comes out now and it comes out. In the 50s and 60s, it was a cultural event, or certainly in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, it was a cultural event. In the case of Stegner, different kind of writer, but you have a writer who is first and foremost a writer. We're talking about prose, acuity of insight, vision, those kind of things. An activist, an environmentalist, an educator, setting up the creative writing program at Stanford, an advocate for writers, for a region, for environmental policy, interacting with government agencies, a spokesperson. Is that a unique? Well, it's not. I don't know that it's a unique model to Stegner, although he may have embodied it in a unique kind of way. Is that a model that is now, in the fragmented world we live in, even possible anymore? Are we really talking about something that is an avatar of a gone time?
Well, I hope not. but I don't know the answer to that, really. I don't know, and I'm obviously probably prejudiced, although I had certainly my differences with my old man, but I don't know anybody quite. I can't think of any other American writer quite like him in terms of the breadth of his, you know. He was truly a man of letters and accomplished at a lot of, as you say, he was, although there's certainly historians who don't think he's a good historian, but they still go on and say that the Beyond the 100th Meridian is the most important book written on the West ever, and stuff like that. I don't really, you know, he's an icon in the environmental movement and above with conservationists and preservationists. And that piece, The Wilderness Letter, is, chiseled in stone it's been called by many people the most eloquent statement in defense of wilderness that has ever been written. You know, Henry David Thoreau get lost, you know. So there's all that stuff, and then all I can say is that every single book of his, with the exception of maybe one of the two of the first Fire and Ice, maybe, On a Darkling Plain, one of the very first little novels that he ever wrote. Every single book is in print. And that's, he's been dead for 15 years. And every single book is still in print, and do people read them? I can testify that I see the royalty statements. I will also testify that I don't get the royalties, but I am the literary executor, so I know, you know, that, yeah, they're not only in print, but people are still reading. So,
I mean, I guess without, looked at me, David, so I didn't really have anything to say about whether that's still possible, except to agree that I hope it's still possible for someone to range that broadly in a career, but just to speak for historians, you know, well, Bill's the real historian, I'm kind of a lapsed historian, but you know, historians have long had this debate about writing and you know, the place of storytelling and historical writing, and I think Stegner went a long way in his novels, you know, especially something like Angle of Repose, and showing history, historians, that one of the best ways to write history was through stories. Would you say, Bill?
Absolutely.
And so I think that he's had an impact on the profession of history as well.
Yeah. Well, what I was going to, and what my two cents worth are, as we wrap up here, I suppose, is just the sense that, you know, as Jenny and I sort of talked back and forth as to how writing and activism are sort of morphing a little bit from the big wilderness pattern to something a little bit more urban, and we look at sort of the work that Bill McKibben has been doing lately through his website in terms of getting people sort of ginned up over how the world is turning and we need to be moving quickly. I just have to think that as long as Stegner's prose is still in print, there are going to be people out there that will stumble upon this writing and the melody of his words and his descriptions of the West and find themselves deeply moved and find themselves trying to figure out a way that wilderness model might actually have some sort of relevance, if not in specifics, but in tone and in depth that would apply to the more sort of local battles that we find ourselves fighting.
I just think that the his own reflection as he aged and talked about his work was an unspoken, at least as far as I know, unspoken fear that the work would become merely elegy for a lost West, a lost vision of America. And that's the real crux right there for me. You know, I agree, it's a wonderful thing those books are in print and for students and others to find them. But if they represent a lost world, that's the tragedy.
And do you think they do, or do we think?
I think they do, in a sense. I think Stegner's life, which is described mostly by just the 20th century, or the entirety of the 20th century, is a life of, from the Depression forward, of a certain kind of middle class or everyday American discovery of the wide open places of the American West, and he was a narrator of that for people. And then he was the cautionary voice that we better watch it. Put too many people out there doing too many things to that landscape, we're going to ruin it. So I think it's of a time and a context that is very different now. And I think he in that respect, his work does become time-capsuled.
I think we will turn it over to some questions from you guys in the audience. Justin is back there with a wireless microphone. And raise your hand, and he will come around. We'll call on you, and he'll come around. And
one thing you've only indirectly addressed is the state of the contemporary West, other than the fact it's over. First of all, preface, I'm sort of a product of both the urban LA West and 10 years in the Cowhand West, so I come from both camps. My question is, don't you see the psychological West still alive? I'm talking about Hollywood, when it first started. People coming from all over the country, all over the world, reinventing themselves, creating a new world industry in the wilderness. Same thing in the Silicon Valley. All these individuals come, gathering together, building a new community. None of these types of things ever happened east of the divide. It's west divide these things happen. Also downtown L.A. Want to talk about the Wild West 10 years ago? Again, to me, I see the Western experience still existing and still very much alive. Response?
Anyone want to jump in on that?
Could. Paige, did you?
Well, this is up to you historians.
I think the ethos is there. I agree. I think the ethos is there. You know, you go to LAX any given day of the week, and you see people hungry to begin anew and rejuvenate or reinvigorate their lives and coming to California, Southern California, do so. So I think the Western ethos in that regard is alive. But the particular lynching, linking of it... Particular,
obviously, it's
I wanted to say linchpin.
We'll edit that out of the podcast.
Particular linking of that to landscape, I think, is in peril, myself.
And I think that may have to do more with a kind of technological frontier as opposed to necessarily a geographical frontier, because I think that those kinds of innovative communities or developments are happening, certainly not just in the Western United States. I think they're happening across the globe. It's more of a kind of mindset as opposed to a physical.
Well, yeah, Stegner's a case in point in the sense that I suspect that in his Stanford years, as what we would call the sort of early Silicon Valley developed, Stegner was very active in the preservation of those foothills by 280, precisely because of the costs of that discovery of the Silicon Valley opportunities by thousands and thousands of people. So he himself, I suspect, his own life is full of the costs of that.
And
what I was going to say is what your question reflects for me is just sort of a desire that we all sort of have that the West does still exist, and I think as Bill gets to, the ethos is still there. We all want to believe that it's there, but I have to think that as you look around and look at the economic sort of exigencies that are crushing, you know, coming down upon us right now, that sort of ethos where you have the choices that the West once represented, I think those choices are becoming fewer and far between.
Yeah, I think, you know, every 5 years the cultural critics declare that the Western is dead, and then you get some wonderful Western come out. But so I think that the Western myths are still obviously very much alive. You can still go to dude ranches and, you know, in all kinds of ways. But I think that the contradictions that are partly a result of those myths have sort of manifested themselves in such extreme ways and nowhere more so than in Los Angeles, that we've moved away from those myths maybe a little bit in terms of the ways that we actually, in terms of the ideas that we're using to actually shape our landscapes. So that Los Angeles, I think you see a very conscious effort by people to move away from, say, the ideas of, you know, Los Angeles is the American dream or the American nightmare, and really try to deal with, say, okay, what is Los Angeles actually on the ground apart from that, you know, myth that has shaped it for so long?
Nathaniel West, right. West. That's a little different West, isn't it?
And one of the things I was just going to quickly to say is that as I try to imagine what the West is going to look in 50 to 100 years from now, as we look at these small towns, the sort of boom towns in Montana and Wyoming that have sort of popped up and then perhaps disappear as oil and gas leases disappear, you know, as the drought sort of starts weighing heavy upon us all, you know, are we going to see the West become a little bit more sort of come full circle, so it looks a little more perhaps like it was, you know, when you know, 100 years or so ago? I don't know. And will that reignite the whole sort of ethos of the West?
Only if there's an earthquake.
David?
That's what Lucy said. In the front. Wait, the microphone is coming.
I wonder if the speakers could comment on what I'll call the impact of newcomers, quote unquote, to the West on what's traditionally been the culture of the West. I guess I'm thinking of a lot of people from California, but other areas too, moving into a lot of the Western states. And it seems like there's a plus and a minus. I mean, certainly where large population agglomerations are going on, Phoenix, Las Vegas, and so on, we're getting more McDonald's and Walmarts and so on. But on the other hand, there are some people anyway that are going to what you might call the more environmentally desirable parts of the West, small towns, maybe some rural areas and so on, that really carry with them environmental protection values, And there may be a little bit of conflict with the ranchers and so on to begin with, but in some cases, they work out a kind of a modus operandi of actually working together with the ranchers to preserve landscape and so on. So I wonder if you could comment on those two different impacts that newcomers have in the West, and are there any differences in different regions, whether it be Idaho versus Colorado versus New Mexico and Utah and so on?
What an interesting question. Well, no one's done a study that I know of to look at, for instance, Colorado and New Mexico going blue in the recent elections and the impact of California voters on that. People have left California and moved to those Rocky Mountain places. Probably you could sustain that, I bet. Certainly Stegner, as a student of ranching and a student of farming, plains farming, Stegner would have applauded and, in fact, probably pushed for some of these cooperative efforts between environmentally conscious people and ranchers. He was not in the same league with Abbey, for instance, who painted in very thick lines of black and white about good and evil. And Stegner's much more muted and subtle that way. So Stegner would have seen this coming or been at the forefront of it in some of his writing. I can't pick a thing he wrote right now off the top of my head to know that. But there's undoubtedly land use and land policy innovations coming out of the interior West that are dynamic and interesting. And this is not the topic for this for tonight, but I think sometimes here in Southern California we get a little smug about our place at the innovative edge of environmental thinking when, in fact, for certain things, it's either in Portland, Seattle, or Denver,
no.
Albuquerque, et cetera. So,
Bill, no.
With the exception of the LA River, truthfully, with the exception of the LA River and what's being designed for that.
Thank you. As an unrepentant Easterner, I'm from the disgraced state of New Jersey, but now a proud Angeleno. And I'm kind of curious to talk about the continuation of this Western myth, or how is it strengthened or weakened? And to my ears, coming from a state that for years has given so much to the federal treasury and received so little back, and I read with such glee, Stegner turned me on to DeVoto, and I was reading that about how much the West claims individualism and then requires federal help for the dams and so forth. So, but it seems to me that the myth of the West is, Mr. Ulin, you kind of epitomized it. You said what's from the Northeast is is American. What's regional? What others is regional? And I kind of disagree with that, because for me personally, I think that, as was in our last election, who's a real American and who's not? What is Western is American. And what is from the East? I come from a state, the property of which sits on Ellis Island, which to me is the ultimate place of rebirth and regeneration, but we don't acknowledge that. We have this idea of the wilderness somehow is cleansing, and California is cleansing, and I'm a proud resident of California now, but I'm curious to see, especially with those latest election cycles, if we could exist without our myth of the West, or where do you see it going in the future? I mean, it was so evident to me, personally, in my ears, in the past election. And just kind of the way we define ourselves, the way we don't want to be from New Jersey, but we want to be from California. I'm curious of what you think about that.
I grew up in Manhattan. And, you know, I actually think that in some ways, I think culturally, certainly the Northeast is still the cultural engine, or still sees itself as the cultural engine of the country. And it's very difficult outside of movies or various pop culture genres that are accepted as not being a product of the Northeast to, you know, for instance, it's very difficult for writers who aren't from the East Coast to be seen as anything other than regional writers. So that's fueling a lot of what I'm saying. I do think in terms of the election, actually, that the failure of the McCain-Palin ticket to sell a real American notion that some people were more American than others seems to belie the point that small town values were somehow more American than the coastal elites. And hopefully that paradigm is disappearing, because I think that in the end, we're all in it together. One of the things that I think is really interesting about
you know, just to bring it back to the subject, one of the things I think is really interesting about Stegner's writing, particularly in terms of water and particularly in terms of the West, is that water, we can substitute resources in general, but in his writing here, water as the particular resource becomes the fundamental engine of community because there is only a little bit or only a small amount to go around, and so there has to be a way in which it's shared because you can't, the fact that a river or a stream runs through your property doesn't mean that you get to suck all the water up and not leave any for anyone else. And I think that if we as a culture can start moving in that direction and strip away some of these kind of the downside of regionalism, then I think that's a positive development. The corollary to that, which comes back to the question of place I was raising at the end, is that I would hate to see a kind of cultural homogeneity. And I think that, you know, the same thing is true if you think about immigrant groups that come to the United States or come to any country. What's the balance between identity and assimilation? How do you weigh those things? How do you maintain how do you stay true to your own cultural heritage and yet become part of the larger culture of the country and somehow expand what the larger culture of the country means? In some ways, I think it's an abstract answer to your question, but I'd love to see that be where we progress to, and rather than this notion of what, you know, is this a true American or is that a true American or whatever.
David, do you think, that just makes me think, you know, both McCain and Palin were also really trying to trade on Western myths. I mean, Palin most obviously from, you know, shooting moose and having people watch her make moose hot dogs. And the Republicans, of course, and that brand of Republicanism was really attached to this kind of idea of the West, if you think of Bush and the way he tapped into that, or, you know, Reagan before him. I mean, I'm going to just be really inarticulate because I've never really thought about it until you mentioned that, but do you think that it does show some kind of decline in power of that myth to, you know, that's somehow connected to...
Well, I think what's interesting about McCain and Palin is that the thing that they sort of disregarded, I think, or didn't take into account for was the fact that for me, the essence of the myth of the West is this ability to transcend the past. And for they were rooted in the past. And you know, Obama, I think one of the great appeals in his story is the fact that, yeah, this was a guy that proved to us that we can transcend the past. And for that reason, your question, you know, I think less about the myth of the West than I do more about the myth of America. And I think that America and the West are often, in some ways, sort of interchangeable in that manner.
Well, I think there's a bigger issue here at work, too. I mean, that's a huge question and a fascinating one. But... we haven't seen political journalists make as much hay as I think could be made intellectually over the pivotal role of Hawaii, Alaska, and Arizona in the recent election. And you could toss in Los Angeles and Occidental College in there. You could probably make that fit. But there's a way in which Western places as launching pads for political careers and political cultures has really gotten, it's been important for a long time, but this election, there's a particular coalescence of these very Western places that tended to be viewed oftentimes as very exotic, Hawaii and Alaska in particular. Well, yes and no.
And the other thing I'll say, too, is that I think if you think about it in terms of Obama representing, I mean, politics aside, now just talking metaphorically, if you think about Obama representing a kind of a real vision of what America looks like. You know, when I went to vote in my neighborhood in Los Angeles, the people I saw, you know, in some ways, he looked like the America that I was living in. It was multiracial, it was multi-ethnic, it was a melange of influences. I mean, it's a country of mutts, as he put it in that press conference. And I think that too is another, maybe this comes back to what Jenny's saying. I do think it's interesting that I hadn't thought about him as a Hawaiian, as being a Westerner in that way, but I think it's an interesting question, and this is totally off the subject we're talking about what the real American, what is the myth of the real American, what was it and what is it becoming? Are we shifting from a kind of, you know, the traditional Western myth that you're talking about into a kind of more amorphous mixing, you know, the real melting pot.
It is what we're talking about, though, in a sense, because had Stegner been born a generation later, if he was still with us, does he put his next novel in Los Angeles? You know, there's some...
And the West is where you see these things happen first. So the West, one of the hallmarks of the West is it's more culturally diverse. and always has been. So it's always kind of at the head of the curve.
David, we can take maybe two more questions.
Okay, so we have this gentleman in the front right here.
Just a quick comment. Illinois can be included in the West. Is that correct, Paige? My question really is directed, as a kickoff at least, to your edited volume of letters, selected letters, and there must have been a lot more, obviously. I took away from reading this that a lot of what defined him was his enormous contact through correspondence reflected here with a vast number of people from the little library in Saskatchewan that was creating an art center to the Bernard DeVoto's and a vast array of people. What did you take from your pulling this together that helps to define him by the breadth of his contact with a wide variety of people?
Well, I think you're absolutely right. And one of the astonishing things about doing that, that selected letters was not only how many of them there were and how broad his epistolary base, but the fact that he never, ever left a letter go unanswered. From the most, you know, a sixth grader in Cedar Rapids writing a little note from her class where they read The Butcher Bird or something, he would write a long and thoughtful response, not a dash off a card or he would treat it as if it were, you know, the question of the day. And he would respond with a two-page, single-spaced, typed letter answering, and phenomenal letter writer. He did this every morning. He had specific routines that he almost never altered. Out in his study by 7:30, and he started his day by writing three or four letters, just to warm up the fingers, as he said. Well, of course, he only typed with two, so how long does that take?
Did he email?
No. He didn't have a computer, and he wouldn't. He wouldn't even have an electric typewriter. He had an old manual typewriter, and I tried once to get him, although I was sort of dragged kicking and screaming into the 20th century, I guess it was, late, and I didn't want anything to do with computers either. But when I did discover them, I tried to sell my old man on him, and he was kind, and he listened and smiled and sort of guessed that he'd managed to get along okay, all right, without this long. He wasn't, you know, said something about old horses and or old dogs and new tricks or something. So what was my point? Oh, so he warmed up his fingers every day, as he put it, by writing letters. And what I was struck by in doing that, putting that together, was, as I said, the seriousness of the response to the fifth grader was just exactly the same as to David Packard or Barack Obama, if he had been writing. I mean, so it was a kind of revelation to me. And the kindness and thought that he put into these. And these were not, again, they weren't dashed off. They were literary works, these letters. Oh, sure, yeah. I mean, he had a considerable correspondence with a lot of very interesting people. And I didn't get that collection is just his letters because if you start printing other people's letters, then you get into permissions issues, and it's a nightmare of unbelievable. So, but yeah.
That's a Western spirit.
We have time for one more, I think. Okay, one more, this gentleman over here.
Coming on top of the question about his relationship with others through his letter writing, what I think is so profound about Wallace Stegner is his relationship to the land. And what I'm curious about is I think that his authenticity and passion for talking about Western landscape and environment, how it was forged by his own early years growing up in the West. He was a Westerner. I mean, you can talk a lot about how maybe Reagan portrayed a Westerner or Bush, but these are sort of quasi-Westerners. They spent a lot of time in the East. They weren't, as I see it, as authentic. And I'm wondering if you could comment on his formative years, how he spent time in wide open spaces and learned the rhythms and the sounds and all the sensory elements of the West, and how that played into his passionate advocacy for the West in later years.
Well, how to attack that question? It's my favorite book of his is Wolf Willow, which was the story of growing up in East End, Saskatchewan, in the Cypress Hills, and everything that you're saying about him being a part of it. It's not as if he went to something to learn about it. He learned about it before he ever knew he knew anything about it. And he always, in fact, I was thinking earlier, some question earlier about history. He didn't think of himself as a historian. He said he wrote the history because he was fascinated by John Wesley Powell and the whole question that Powell dealt with in the West. And if he hadn't been, if he hadn't lived in the Colorado Plateau, in the Plateau Country of Utah, if he hadn't read Dutton's High Plateaus of Utah and the Tertiary History of the Grand Canyon when he was a college student living in Salt Lake, if it hadn't all been a part of the sort of mix, he would never have written that book. He wouldn't have been interested in it. He wouldn't have written the biography of Benny DeVoto if he hadn't known Benny and been a kind of a protege. So all of these things came out of the life and the living of it, rather than, I guess, I'm not putting it very well, but he was, was coming out of here and not going there to get it.
He also, you could write a literary essay or a dissertation, I think, on his visual acuity, because he must have seen better than most of us, I think, because you read the fiction, and there's a visual landscape of seeing the West there that's crystal clear. You know, it's hawk-like.
Extraordinary.
Yeah. Well, I want to thank all of you for coming. I'd like to thank the panelists for being here.
Aloud Audio is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Annenberg Foundation, City National Bank, contributors to the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and Donna and Martin J. Wolf. Media support provided by KUSC 91.5 FM and KCET. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.